Welcome back to Legal Latitudes, the podcast where law, life, and personal stories all collide. Our guest today is Ike Kaludi, a powerhouse personal injury lawyer with Ecuadorian and Indian roots, a Catholic upbringing, and one hell of a journey. He went from being an altar boy to customer service at Southwest Airlines to the courtroom, where he now fights for injured clients with fire, heart, and a sharp legal mind. We talked about it all, how his upbringing shaped his voice as a trial lawyer, what Jerry Spence's Trial Lawyers College taught him about vulnerability and authenticity, and how he turned the fence gym records into a win at trial. It's all here. Ike opens up about the importance of honesty with juries, how to earn trust, and what it really takes to prepare for cross-examination and trial. Whether you're a new lawyer, a veteran litigator, or just someone who loves a good underdog story, you don't want to miss this episode. So let's get into it. Mr. Ike Kaludi, thank you for being here with me today. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Thanks for having me.
I was checking your bio from altar boy to you were part of a Catholic, right, environment growing up from your family. I know because I know you that originally you're from Ecuador. Your parents are from Ecuador. So why don't you tell us about that story of immigration that I like to talk about in my podcast?
So I was an altar boy. My mother, she's from Ecuador, Ecuadorian Italian, actually. My dad was born in India, Bombay, India.
Oh, wow.
And they both had Mexican restaurants in El Monte, California. And so they met there. And my mom, being a Catholic, she who had immigrated from Ecuador, first to arrived in New York and then came to California. She's like, no, my son needs to be Catholic.
Right.
Y hablar español. So, I went to Catholic school with Irish nuns from second grade to high school, and I was an altar boy.
So how old was your mom when she moved to New York?
I think she was about 20.
20.
And I think she worked at Thrifty's. I recall her telling me stories about selling ice cream, like, scoops of ice cream.
Right.
At the, and somewhere in Manhattan or Brooklyn.
Right.
But yeah.
And what is it? Did she move with her family or she moved alone or with a boyfriend at the time, being 20 years old? Like, what made her move from Ecuador to the U.S.?
You know, I think for most, you know, folks born abroad, they come to the United States to contribute and to make something of themselves, to have a better future, you know, and she instilled that in us.
Right.
And so she, you know, she came at a young age. My grandmother, God bless her soul, lived to be 94 years old. She came first, and then my mother came over, and then an uncle came over.
Okay. Yeah. So most of your family, they are all here?
Not most, actually. My mother and siblings.
Okay.
They're in California.
Okay. What about your Indian side, your dad?
So
what's the story behind that?
I never went to India. And I have a half brother and sister. One of them, she's a photographer, professional photographer.
Wow.
She's now doing the photography on my website.
Really?
Yeah. And my brother, I think he's an engineer at GMC.
Okay.
Yeah.
They live over there?
No. My sister lives in San Francisco Bay Area.
Okay.
And my brother, he lives in Detroit, I think.
Okay. So, Ike, how is it that you decide to become a lawyer? So, you're growing up in this Catholic environment. You have this work ethic that your parents gave you growing up, right? You know, being a lawyer is a hard drill. And at least for me, it was intimidating before I made the decision. It seemed like hard to overtake the amount of reading, right? So when is it that you make that decision, I want to be a lawyer?
Well, my father being from India, typical Indian parents, they said, you're either going to be a doctor or a lawyer or an engineer.
Yeah.
Right? So
I listen. I've heard that one before.
Yeah, and so I think I wanted to be a lawyer as young as 14 years of age.
Oh wow!
Yeah, I wanted to be a lawyer. It helped that whenever my dad said black, I said white. He said up, I said down. I argued, and so it just played into my natural talent to be an attorney. So I didn't go directly into law. First, back in 1997, when I graduated from high school, I got picked up. I got hired by Southwest Airlines back in 97, and I learned a lot working there. They were the number one company to work for in America. And one of the things that they told us, that they taught us when they took us to Dallas for 3 weeks for training at Southwest Airlines, they said, well, we can teach you the processes. We can teach you how to do things, but we can't teach your personality. So a lot of what we want from you is to have your personality come out.
Right.
Working for Southwest. And back in 97, 98, that's when they used to tell jokes. And, you know, those were the fun days when you were flying the airline. So I never forgot about that. That was the lesson that I learned, that, you know, you have to do what you're good at, what you gravitate to, your personality, what you have an affinity for. So arguing was one of the few things that right. I knew I was good at.
Yeah, and you had a nice personality, so that's probably helpful when it comes to speaking to a jury and coming across as a likable person, right?
Well, interesting you say that. So I think a lot of people on the defense would say that I'm not a likable person.
Hmm.
Right?
Well,
because
they may be biased.
They might be biased. There might be some truth. You know, I can appreciate the argument. And I also came into law a little bit older in life. So a lot of the bullshit that I think I identify as bullshit from the defense, you know, I'll call them out on it. Mm-hmm. And so there's that. But also having grown up around women, you know, I grew up around my mother, my grandmother, my two sisters. You know, you don't grow up being aggressive, right? And they always put you in check. And, you know, you get a little bit more sensitive on issues. You're more, you know, you're just aware of those things. And I think that helped. That helped me growing up. You know, my religious background, the women in my family, you know, they taught me to be true, but to be true to myself, but, you know, to be mindful.
Mm-hmm.
And we talk a lot about mindfulness now, but,
right.
You know, I think that's one of the nice things about having grown up with women is that you're not just, you know, we can be very right, we can be very left brain and logical. And the emotion, although we talk about how it's not good to present that to the jury, we're all emotional. Even the judges who say, look, you know, I'm taking the emotion out of it. I don't think that's true. I think it's human to have emotion and so to be aware of it. And so when you're talking to juries, you know, they can, I truly believe that they have feelers for bullshit. And, you know, if you're not going to be sincere, if you're not going to, you know, show your feelings, disclose your weaknesses and be transparent, you know, then they're going to pick up on that. So you shouldn't be doing our line of work as plaintiff's lawyers if you're not prepared to be transparent, to be vulnerable.
Mm-hmm. In the process of becoming a trial lawyer and getting to put yourself out there, I've experienced that there is a lot of learning about ourselves, right? Knowing how to handle our own emotions and being vulnerable, which for some lawyers, it's hard to do. Right. So based on what you're saying, it seems like you have undergone through this learning path since you're a young boy to then become the lawyer that you are right now.
Yeah, I would agree. And I mean, it's a compliment, you know, to be told that you are aware of yourself, that you're, I think, conscious about your you know, self-awareness. I think that's a compliment because there's so much dopamine released through our cell phones and iPads and we get so disconnected and for what we do speaking to juries, you know, we have to be honest. One of the things that helped me get there or at least further my path to where I'm at now is having gone to Jerry Spence's Trial Lawyers College and for 3 weeks, and I went as an actual law student. and they just started the program where they were accepting law students because they wanted students who were still in law school before they developed bad habits. I think this was the train of thought in accepting law students, is have the law student learn before they get in the courtroom how to be vulnerable, how to obviously use Jerry Spence's methods and kind of develop your self-awareness. Because at the ranch, I mean, I made tremendous growth personally. You know, we were drawing and we were singing and we were performing things that are, you know, we were being vulnerable. But we also had to do a lot of, you know, looking within. And so that helped me develop the awareness of being vulnerable. And, you know, fast forward, having my daughter, you know, I learned that was a little bit maybe too much. And having a young girl also helped round me, you know, round the edges a little bit.
Right. So I remember we were going in, to trial in a case, and my former boss shared something with the client that he had never shared with me, although we had spent many, many years together, you know. And after he shared that with the client, I remember the client opening way more than he should, because he basically, my former boss, showed a vulnerability, right? So it I feel it works for good, for to do a good, you know, job, not only with the jury, but it also works when you want your clients to open up, and even sometimes with the defense expert, you know, in different ways, right? Because I've done a little bit of what the TLC, Trial Lawyers College, does, which is a psychodrama. I did a couple of those weekend, you know, seminars. And they make you step on the shoes of the expert you're the boss in cross-examining. And
psychodrama, right. That, yeah.
Yeah. So what year was this when you went to Jerry Spence?
Oof. I think it was about 12, 13 years ago.
Okay. And you said I started late in the business of law. Why is that? What were you doing before?
Well, I became a young dad. I was a dad at the age of 19.
Oh, wow.
And now I knew I wanted to go to law school, but I was working at Southwest and you know, making good money. I was traveling, but I knew that I needed to focus and just get on the right track. Ultimately, I knew I was going to go to law school still because I wanted to be a good influence for my son. And fast forward to now, he's actually in law school. My son is now in law school in his second year. And thank you. So I worked for Southwest Airlines for a while. Then I cashed in my 401 and I opened up some businesses. I was selling gold and silver in the malls. I had multiple locations. But I knew that I wanted to do something.
Not to stereotype, but the Indian roots they're showing, huh?
I think so, yeah. No, right. my parents were business people. They had business minds. And at one point I was thinking about going to MBA, you know, getting MBA business school, and I thought, well, I feel like I already know a lot of it. It's true. I mean, there's a lot of stuff I could learn, but I knew that I wanted to practice law, and I knew that I wanted to represent underrepresented people. I knew that I wanted to represent the voice that's not heard that often. And sure enough, my current client base, a big portion of it is representing minorities, women. But I knew it back then that I wanted to do that. And I knew that I wanted to kind of the David versus Goliath. I was always attracted to the fight. Even though I might lose, I knew I wanted to do it. So I ultimately decided to go back to school, went to UCLA, and then went to law school. I'm sorry, I worked for an attorney for a few years just to make sure like I could do this. And I worked my way up from an assistant to like a legal secretary to a paralegal. And at that point I started, and he was a plaintiff's lawyer, two of them, and I was negotiating on behalf of the attorney. You know, it wasn't the unauthorized practice of law, but I was getting close. And at that point, I said, well, yeah, I want to go to law school and move this forward.
Nice. So now you are representing, minorities. And what's the area of expertise? Because you have had some great results on TBI cases and spine injury cases lately, right? Is that your specialty currently in personal injury?
It is personal injury. I started off doing workers' compensation. I started off with workers' compensation to pay the bills, keep the lights on. What I didn't know is that and I also was doing personal injury, but I had more workers' comp clients in the very beginning with my ex-law partner. And what I didn't realize was how much of an asset workers' compensation practice is to a personal injury lawyer. Because in a workers' compensation cases and the system itself, you are looking at medical records all the time. I mean, the case is based on it. And they don't teach us medicine in law school. And, I mean, they don't teach us a lot of things in law school, but they don't teach you medicine. They don't teach you how to depose a doctor, right? Because you're asking him questions and you're in his sandbox and he's going to run circles around you. So the workers' comp really helped me because all of a sudden I was thrown in deposing these doctors. And I started catching the little slight, words that they would use to call my client a liar or, you know, to suggest malingering, you know, positive for Waddell signs, non-organic symptoms, the subjective doesn't match up with the objective. Yeah, all this, right? And so I started seeing a pattern. And so fast forward to me doing primarily personal injury cases, and I can see it. In fact, in the last trial I just did, it was about 4 weeks in Alameda County, and the defense medical examiner had the typical playbook arguments. Should have been better after so many weeks or months, and suggesting that the person, that my clients were not telling the truth. And so, you know, kind of what you would read in Friedman's Polarizing the Case, you know, you take them on the stand in front of everybody you polarize it and you say, well, what are you saying? You know, and are you saying this? Are you saying this? And it's interesting because the jury sees them not take the position that the defense has been arguing throughout litigation for months or years. Now you have the actual doctor on the stand whom they're depending on for this opinion, and the doctor's not willing to go out there and do it. So, but it's that kind of experience when you're deposing doctors on a common basis that you learn to pick up the little cues that they give.
Right. You basically box the doctor in a position where they have to pick sides. They have to pick whether they go with what you're saying or what they want to say or what the defendant is saying, right? And if they go with what the defendant is saying, what you're doing is polarizing the case, and that has other ways to be approached to, right? Once you polarize the doctor, you can undermine their position. That's a very powerful and good technique that I think Friedman is like one of the biggest proponents of that, right?
Yeah, he wrote a book about it, and right. He talks about doing it in a deposition. So I treat every deposition like it's a cross-examination in front of the jury. I videotape it, and I ask the questions, and I lock them in, and I'll polarize them. So when they get to trial, they don't stick to their story. I just go directly to the transcript. And in some cases, I'll always record them. I'll even play what they say in my opening. If the judge allows it, I'll play the video of the deposition or where the doctor gives the response. And so, my estimate is I take about 100 depositions a year. And I've done so for several years, especially since we've gone Zoom for all depositions. And I basically boil down the defense medical examination into two categories. There's the ones that will be reasonable, that will give you causation, will give you the injuries, right? But their limitation, well, they'll stop is they'll say, oh, you know, we don't think that the person is injured at the 3-month mark, you know. And so you have that reasonable defense medical examiner. And then you have the ones that are really out there, that are like arguing that it's something completely different. The car crash had almost nothing to do with it. And I used to fear those defense medical examiners, those doctors. I used to fear them. And I thought to myself, what am I going to do? Now I love it because they give you rope. They give you the rope to hang them by. When they're so unreasonable in front of the jury, you know, in those cases, you just have to demonstrate to the jury that they're unreasonable. And they'll never have any evidence or treatises to support their argument that it's totally unrelated or that they should have resolved after so many months. But so this is what I love so much. This is one of the things that I love doing is deposing the doctor, because they usually fall into those two categories. In the first category, where they're being reasonable, you can tell the jury, look, even their own doctors, don't listen to my doctors. Their own doctor says causation, there's causation here. There was an actual injury, you know? And what we disagree is the length of time that the pain should or actually has continued for the person following the crash.
Yeah. So it's basically finding agreements and use them in your favor, and then also finding disagreements and trying to box them into these disagreements that somewhat are not, you know, supported by the records, by the reality, and by the science by the end of the day, right? What the treatise says, what the science says, when they say, no, this cannot happen, you have plenty of evidence, medical evidence, that this could have happened a different way.
Funny that you say that. A lot of my depositions, I will start off with the defense examiner, with the doctor for the defense, talking about what we agree on. You know, there's certain things that they have to agree on. Otherwise, they look bad or, you know, they can get in trouble. And so I'll start off with what we agree. You know, for example, you know, a sprain injury is a ligamentous injury, right? Otherwise known as alteration of motion segment integrity. I'll ask a question such as, you know, isn't flexion extension x-rays the gold standard for detecting alteration of motion segment integrity or ligamentous injury? Because oftentimes they'll say, well, you know, I didn't see anything, or the MRI didn't pick up a ligamentous injury. But that's not really the way you want to look for it. You want to look for it in examination, and you want to look for it in a flexion extension x-ray. So, but I'll start off with what we agree on, and kind of do a setup, you know, if I see that they're not being reasonable, and then we'll talk about what we disagree with. And
yeah,
sometimes it gets a little heated. I've had, I think, two doctors insult me during deposition, which...
It's the best compliment, no?
I guess it could be a compliment. I guess I'm doing my job. But it's really a gift. It's a gift from the defense.
That too.
And...
especially if you're videoing the deposition.
And I videotape all of them, you know? And so I'll ask them, maybe at the crucial moment when they have an opinion that is just really far out there, I'll say, oh, you know, and also, you know, you're going to call me stupid again or something, you know, some insult. But, yeah, so I'll talk about what we agree on, and then we'll talk about what we don't agree on. And all of that is with the intention of going to trial and making sure that they're locked into what their testimony is, taking them out as far as possible on their opinion.
Okay. And these cases are usually TBI cases and spine injury cases?
So spine injury cases, amputation, brain injury. I did a TBI case where one of the doctors, he's a great doctor by the name of Hector Miranda. He's a triple board certified in traumatic brain injury, pain doctor, and PM&R. And we had a case where my client was rear-ended by a box truck. And typically the defense will say, oh, sure, yeah, everyone's got TBI. All the plaintiff's lawyers would just add it on as an afterthought. So one of the challenges in that case was to have objective evidence. And one of the things that the endocrinologist did, along with Dr. Miranda and a team of other doctors, they did a test for growth hormone deficiency and found that this young person had a deficiency in growth hormone, which indicates an injury to the pituitary gland, which happens in a rear-end collision. And so the pituitary gland can be injured in a traumatic acute injury such as a car crash. So the defense for the longest time was saying, well, you know, we don't see it. We don't see it. And, you know, Dr. Miranda, you know, he gives his opinion. He writes a lengthy report. And I think we even offered him at mediation to talk about it, because oftentimes not even the mediator is aware of it. And that case resolved for multi-million dollars because we were able to prove objectively with the science that there was an actual
brain injury. Yeah. Right. So let's talk about brain injury cases in general. Okay, you get a case where the client or potential client's telling you, I'm suffering of all of these symptoms. I assume you have like a list that you go over with the client, right? You decide to sign up the client, and you're going to start what we call, I don't like to use the word work up the case, but you know, you start making the client to go see the right doctors and getting them with the right people by the end of the day. What are those right doctors, the right people? Because I've seen there are different trains or a school of thought. Some lawyers like to involve a neuropsychologist early on. Other lawyers don't like to involve a neuropsychologist at all, but for reviewing the raw data of the other side's neuropsychologist. For example, you know, that's an example. There are different ways to work as a lawyer in these traumatic brain injury cases. What's the way that you like to work with these cases?
First off, let me point out that the defense, part of their playbook oftentimes is that the plaintiff's lawyer is directing the medical treatment.
Right.
And that's a very, you know, volatile topic.
And yeah, and I'm glad that you're mentioning it, because I don't want to come across that, like, I'm saying it's over-treating, like the lawyers are over-treating these clients. You're basically guiding the client so that they get the right care, because it's so complex, and we deal with these cases. I also handle TBI cases, and it's such a complex area of medicine, and there are things changing all the time. So a client, when they come to you and they ask for advice, you're giving them legal advice, right? But you're also guiding them with your experience dealing with these type of cases and pointing them to the right doctors that are going to be able to help these people and treat them well, right?
Yeah, so my experience is that I'll have all types. I have some clients that are very aware of their condition and self-motivated to get treatment, and they're going through their insurance and they're getting treatment. And, you know, for example, in a head injury case, they'll get referred out to a neurologist, and the neurologist will maybe recommend a brain MRI. Mm-hmm. But a TBI is a clinical diagnosis.
Right.
It's not a, you know, something that you see on imaging. Mm-hmm. You know, you may see some positive findings on the MRI, mm-hmm. and that will support the clinical right. finding. But an MRI or a negative MRI is not indication that there's no TBI. No. So I'll have a mix of cases where many of them will go through the insurance. And what we're doing is we're looking at the medical records, and we're looking to see, are there any gaps? Are there any things that are not being issued? For example, you may have some symptomatology that one of the doctors is not focused on. And I've deposed lots of, for example, Northern California Kaiser doctors. They'll be very narrow to what the patient came in, and they may be, you know, for better or worth, the doctor is just trying to focus on the symptom, right? And sometimes the underlying cause not being addressed. And yes, that's where the lawyer can come in.
Right.
And also hopefully the lawyer is working with a nurse or a doctor or some medical expert who can also chime in from a medical perspective, right? And give an opinion, well, okay, this is what's missing in this case.
Right.
And so, you know, you can talk to the client, say, you know, ask your primary care physician about this issue of being referred out to a specialist. And in other times, especially when we get in the expert phase, which is very close to trial, you know, you are disclosing an expert who is looking at something kind of in the big picture. So it may be a neuropsych. And, you know, I have an amputation case. We haven't even gone to mediation, and we've brought in a neuropsych because there's a lot of mental, there's just a lot of weight from this injury to the person that they suffered a catastrophic injury that they have to deal with mentally. And so right. the neuropsych will come in and look at different things But the good thing in having an early neuropsych, I think one of your questions is, there's a debate of whether to do it early or later. Mm-hmm. I think it's helpful to have a neuropsych if you use a neuropsych.
Right.
I don't always, use a neuropsych, and I have my issues sometimes with that direction. But if you use them early and you do the battery of tests first, like the MMPI-2, and the test for malingering, test for memory, and you do that first and you really want to hear from your doctor, he'll give you the honest opinion about what the case says. And then it's interesting because there's a train of thought. First of all, these tests might be off with a neuropsych if they come from a non-English-speaking country. There may be socioeconomic issues. Maybe the person that got a standardized test, and that will impact or skew their results. So there's just all these things on whether or not you even want to use a neuropsych. But if you do, there's also this concept that the person, when they take the battery of tests the first time and they take it again the second time, there'll naturally be a skew in the results because they've seen the test.
The practice test.
Yeah.
The practice effect is called.
Okay, yeah. And so, there's benefit to you doing that test, to doing the battery of tests first before the other side does. And you'll go in equipped with that. And I will oftentimes go to battle with the other side about their test because on the one hand, their defense medical examiner, their orthopedic doctor will say, no, I don't think this plaintiff is lying, malingering, exaggerating, and they give their best effort during the physical examination. So then why has the defense hired a neuropsych and they're going to test 8 different tests for lying and malingering? Why? Why is that necessary when your own defense medical examiner for the defense is not making that argument? And so, that might be a situation where you can pit their two experts at trial against each other. Like, which is it? Is it their one expert? Is it the other expert? So, it could be a good thing. It could be a bad thing. But I usually will go to, have a battle over what exact tests are going to be done. In California, we'll oftentimes see the defense wants to do 2 doctors at the neuropsych examination. And, the CCP, the Code of Civil Procedure, only talks about 1, right? And you get 1. That's essentially 2 different opinions. And so we'll always resist 2 doctors.
And it's a mental exam too. So they need a motion or an agreement, right?
Exactly. So they don't need a motion. They're entitled to it, but we need agreement. And if there's no agreement, then, they can file their motion. There's no sanctions associated with it. Unlike the IME, the what's been called the IME, but it's really a defense medical examination, you probably would get in trouble for not offering your client for the orthopedic or the physical exam.
Yeah, like the parts of the body that are put in dispute in the case, right?
Say again?
The parts of the body that are under dispute, like the injured parts.
Right, yeah, you want to limit the physical orthopedic examination to that. And that's why what I said about the neuropsych, if lying and malingering is not at issue, even by the defense, orthopedic doctor, why are they testing for all this stuff? I have a problem with these tests, but that's another podcast.
So. Yeah, that's a long rabbit hole we get into, right?
Yeah.
So you had a pretty good result lately. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that? Because I think you got a great result. I don't know if you want to disclose who was on the other side, of course.
Well, it was one of the larger insurance companies, and it was essentially their in-house counsel, very experienced senior trial attorney and an associate, and it was a rear end collision, and
it's one of the larger insurance companies that are not paying anything right lately.
Yes.
And that could be any
that could be any
but specifically this one.
There's one really large one which you'll see their names on the sponsoring basketball and football games, NFL games and NBA games. But it was a rear-end collision, and the defendant had Alzheimer's, dementia, when the collision, well, they were diagnosed with it shortly after the collision. I mean, clearly they had the Alzheimer's dementia at the time, and they even showed signs of it at the scene. But the judge did not want to have that information come in. You know, the other side moved to preclude it, and the judge precluded it under the premises that liability was accepted.
Need a trial lawyer who will fight for you? Call Lathrop Law Firm at 760-723-9612 or visit www.lathroplawfirm.com.
And by the way, I have to say, this was a judge in Alameda County, and she is one of the best judges I have ever seen.
So let me understand, because your guy had dementia most likely before the collision, right?
The defendant, yeah, a woman. It was a female.
The defendant had dementia.
Alzheimer's dementia.
Ah, okay. Not your client.
Not my client, yeah.
Ah, okay. Got it.
So the defendant who caused the collision, who rear-ended my clients, had Alzheimer's dementia. And we weren't able to bring that up in trial under the premises that liability is accepted. Right. And so it's not really an issue, and it's 352 prejudicial.
Right. How did you find out that she had Alzheimer's? And
well, they sent us one page medical record.
And was that used as an excuse so that you guys wouldn't take her deposition?
Yeah. Never appeared for deposition.
Okay.
And didn't appear at trial.
Oh, wow.
And we weren't able to say at trials because she had Alzheimer's dementia near the time of the collision up until the date of trial. We weren't even we basically were instructed that the jury was going to be informed that they're not here for a medical reason.
Mm-hmm. And then from for someone that doesn't know how this whole thing works, right? You're not supposed to tell the jury that there is an insurance company involved. Allegedly, you would be going against this defendant, which makes our job harder, right? Because this sympathy plays a role there. Then it's sympathy by feeling bad for this person because, you know, it could be anyone. And it's happened that this person made a mistake. So that's what the defendant wants the jury to know. And then also sympathy because how this person is going to pay for whatever money you're demanding. And you got a several million-dollar result in that case?
And the one that we did, it was a four-week trial. We're actually waiting for the 998 interest and expert fees. So, yeah, it's going to be over $1 million.
Okay, over $1 million. Yeah. So in order
the hearing hasn't happened yet, so we don't know the final amount just yet.
Okay, but in order to get such a substantial verdict, you really need to do a job there on jury selection and during trial, so that these feelings of sympathy are taken out of the jury, because they shouldn't play a role. That's the jury instruction, right? They should not feel. This is not about sympathy. It's about compensation. You're not claiming punitive damages, therefore you're not punishing, right?
Right.
So let's talk about the preparation to get to jury trial.
Well, can I say really quickly about the sympathy thing? I think the defense does a better job at the sympathy card than the plaintiffs. And I'll give you an example. In one trial I had, the defendant was a musician who rented an apartment, right? And they'll instruct their defendants in their, when the defense has their case in chief and they put their client on the stand, that just seems to always come out, you know, that this is a musician, or he's a teacher, or he lives in an apartment, or he rents. In one case I had, the guy had retired from a big investment company. So the defense, in my opinion, does a better job at the sympathy card than the plaintiff. So I don't believe that you should go in with a sympathy card, because I think when you do, you give the other side carte blanche to do it as well too. And so, you know, that it's a double-edged sword.
So we try this case, and the defense attorney would say, our client wants to pay, but wants to pay what's fair. They are basically saying that the client is going to pay. And they should not say that. So the moment that the defense attorney says, our client is going to pay, but they should pay what's fair, what plaintiff is demanding in this case is way too high, they are somewhat opening the door. I know it's a risky door to open because you're not supposed to talk about insurance, but by the fact that they are addressing who will pay for the damages, and everybody knows behind the scenes that it's not going to be the client, it's going to be an insurance company, they should open the door for you to say, well, folks, we don't know if the client is going to pay this, right? But that's risky business.
Yeah, I mean, it comes to mind on one of my cases where you're not supposed to make speaking objections at trial. But the jury's smart. I mean, we have to give jury credit. They have feelers for bullshit. And if you know, I think an objection, you know, if you make a big stink and you stand up and you say, you know, objection, Your Honor, misleading, you know, I don't know how far the judge might let you go. You might even say, it's not true he's going to pay. But you can say, misleading, this is not a true statement. You know, if you make an objection and when that happens, that would be maybe one of the first steps to let the jury know, look, this person's not paying. I haven't quite seen that. Maybe you've seen that in your trials. But yeah, I think it opens the door. I think the better thing is to, you know, ask for curative instruction and something, you know, hopefully the judge would entertain a statement that no, the defendant is not paying, you know, paying for the outcome, for the any verdict, any award. But I think it's case by case basis, right? But if they open the door, you know, I think the rules are so set in stone that reference to just the fact that the defense has insurance, that the defendant has insurance, I bet you, I'm willing to bet, judge is still not going to, you know, allow you to open that door, walk through that. But who knows? If they do, then even better. It's funny, and you, one of the questions that I didn't answer, you asked me, is preparing for trial.
Yeah.
And so this kind of segues into that. So the for this last trial, you know, as you know, we did a boot camp together in Reno, the Trial Lawyers University boot camp with Dan Ambrose, and so I do pull from his you know teachings and talking about brutal honesty, and in this last trial the judge did not want me to speak to the jury. The judge said you need to ask a question within two sentences. So what I did was I talked about brutal honesty, and I talked about the process of voir dire, and just the idea of speaking and talking about bias, you know, between responses from jurors. Like I would pepper it in. And one of the discussions that came up for like 15 minutes was about how insurance companies rip off people who are really injured. We had several different jurors who either themselves or family members were being shortchanged by the insurance company, and all of them seem to have the same theme, which is the insurance company basically wants to minimize your case, wants to say that you're not really injured. And sure enough, that is a lot of the defense's playbooks, right? That's one of the biggest moves in their playbook.
And in that situation, did the defense attorney get rid of those jurors, or what happened?
Not all of them. I think there was some for-cause challenges. But obviously you try to prehab and rehabilitate, you know, before and after. But it was interesting conversation that we had about insurance. So kind of what you were talking about, well, you know, can you talk about insurance? One voir dire, we actually did talk, you know, during the jury selection process, we actually did talk about it. And obviously, I didn't want to have any issues that come up later that I started. So as they were talking about insurance, I would just say, you know, tell me more. And sure enough, they'd go off on the problems that they had with the insurance company. And has anyone else had this experience, you know, that would impact their ability to listen to the evidence and follow the judge's instructions? And other people would talk about it. And that was almost like a freebie, in my opinion. But yeah, it was a frank,
that was great,
brutally honest conversation about insurance.
Right.
And one thing that I also like to do is when we talk about insurance, I'll bring up insurance, and I always think about how it's used in both ways. So we're not allowed to talk about insurance for the defendant. And I like to tell the jury, we're not allowed to also talk about the health insurance, because I've had cases where the jury says we're not going to give future medical expenses, or maybe, you know, they'll really knock down the past medical, but it's usually future medical that they'll give very little or nothing because they're thinking that this person has insurance like Kaiser. So what I like to do in my closing, sometimes in my opening, I say, look, we can't talk about insurance, and you're going to get instructions from the judge that we can't talk about it, and we can't talk about insurance on behalf of the defendant, and you're not to take into account any health insurance that my client may or may not have. You can't factor that in when you're awarding future medical. And by doing that, insurance becomes a little bit of the topic.
Right.
And insurance is now on their mind. And I'm also communicating a true statement, which is they're not supposed to take into account the health insurance. So I'll do that sometimes when insurance is kind of on everyone's mind.
Right.
You know, and maybe remind them a little bit about the insurance.
That's a good way to not say what you want to say and put it in the jury's mind, right?
It is. I mean, you don't want to manipulate the jury, right? I'm sure both agree. You know, it's about brutal honesty both ways, and we want to be transparent. We want to be vulnerable. And we don't want to, we certainly don't want to manipulate.
Mm-hmm.
But the insurance question comes to mind naturally, because we have to have insurance. Otherwise, it's a Prop 213 case in California. Otherwise,
which means
that you can get, so a Prop 213, mm-hmm. 213 case is,
yeah, because like. There are going to be, you know, non-lawyers
outside California. Yeah,
outside.
No. It's fair. It's a fair question. It's basically a scenario where you don't have insurance. And in California, they passed a law that says if you don't have auto insurance for your mm-hmm. vehicle, you get involved in the collision, it's not your fault, you can demand from the other side that they pay for your medical
economic.
And loss of earning, yeah. economic damages.
You don't
but
get
you can't ask
economic.
For pain and suffering,
right.
which could be a big component of it. So,
which, in my opinion, like that's the only payment that goes to the client, right? To compensate the client, because all the other payments go to the doctors, to whatever they had to pay. So basically,
right, the pain and suffering only, yeah, that's
compensates. So,
that's compensation for the plaintiff only. But the insurance is on everyone's mind, but they oftentimes will forget that they may have a bias about the health insurance that the plaintiff has. And you better believe that the defense is constantly bringing up primary care physician and health insurance. Well, actually, they won't mention health insurance. They'll talk about the health insurance by mentioning Kaiser or primary care physician, right? Especially if the person didn't go and get treatment with their primary care physician. Maybe they went with a chiropractor, you know? So you have to address that. But just to kind of, you know, answer your question about the preparation. You know, voir dire is one of my favorites because it's the only time you get to have that exchange
right.
with the jury, and get to know them, and you know, you really want them to talk about their biases. You want them to talk about your biases, their biases to you, and show it, expose it. And, you know, there's a lot of great stuff out there. Keith Mitnick, I really appreciate his books and what he talks about. Dan Ambrose, obviously. And it's about, and Jerry Spence, you know, there's different ways. And we can talk about it on another podcast. You know, whether you're trying to build your tribe with the jury versus really find and expose biases.
Right.
And
getting rid of the bad jurors.
I personally, even though I appreciate building a tribe, I think at the same time you truly do have to, you know, my humble opinion is you really have to look for those folks that are really biased, because, you know, I've lost trial cases, you know, and they say if you're not losing cases, you're not trying cases, and you'll learn that there's sometimes a juror in there that just – your client was never going to have a fair chance.
Right.
They're always going to have a bias either against the type of case, your particular client, maybe you as the attorney, And so you have to talk about that. And so I'm really big on mini openings, not because I want to indoctrinate the jury and I tell it to the judge. I want to give them facts that may not be favorable towards me, that may, you know, may spark someone's bias. And so I'll talk about maybe the fact that my client didn't go to the ER, did not have an, you know, there was no ambulance that was called, that maybe they didn't get treatment for 5, 6 days or a week or more. I'll talk about that in mini, and then in the voir dire, you know, after you ask them to be brutally honest and you talk about their biases, you start talking about these bad facts. And you might have someone says, I don't care. You know, he saw a chiropractor and I hate chiropractors. Now, my opinion, I personally have treated with chiropractors, but I want them to talk about the fact that nothing a chiropractor says is going to be hold, you know, of any value to them. That's a person that is not a good juror. And we say this, right? You know, not every case is meant for every juror. And so you need to find out which jurors are the right juror for that particular case, mm-hmm. right?
So looking backwards, you know, we're talking a little bit on the nitty gritty of trial work and how to deal with, you know, jury selection and whatnot. But let's talk a little bit. Let's go backwards to your experience, because you clerked for Carlos Moreno, right?
So when I was in law school, I
externed
or interned, mm-hmm. however you want to call it, for the California Supreme Court, Carlos Moreno. Before he retired, and that was a great experience. Got to see, you know.
So what I wanted to ask you is, and I did this the other day, I want you to talk to the young Ike that's starting, your son, you know. What are the recommendations you're going to give to your son? Is your son looking to become a trial lawyer like you? Okay, so what are the recommendations you're giving your son after he finishes law school? What are the seminars? What are the things? What are the teachings and decisions that you would recommend that he makes to hopefully be more even more successful than you are?
Well, I think it goes back to what I learned at Southwest Airlines, mm-hmm. back in 1997 about we'll teach you what you need to know, but your personality is why we want you. And one of the things that I try to focus with my son is that, you know, you're gonna learn how to deal with the tactics from the defense in their playbook, but you can't fake who you are.
Right.
So you must be real. You must be real to yourself. You must be real to the world. We cannot have different personalities to you. And this works in my favor when I tell them, hey, you can't have a different personality with me, and push my buttons. And not do that with the world, right? You have to be the same all the time. And I think that's really important for a trial lawyer is if you want a jury to listen to you, to listen to your client, you have to be authentic.
Right, be yourself.
You have to, and that means being yourself. And so you have to discover who you are. I think you have to look inwards. You have to look at your weaknesses, and you have to accept them. You have to embrace them. You know, kind of walk towards the light instead of away from it, and get your head bright so that when you're learning all these different, you're going to seminars and you're reading books and, you know, you get advice from more experienced trial lawyers, you have the right foundation
right.
for it. And it, maybe it's common sense. Maybe what I'm saying is, you know, the obvious, but you get lost in the left brain law school education. And you're thinking about legal arguments and, you know, you think about what the other side is going to argue and you forget to be, you know, authentic.
Right.
And so I don't care how smart you are. If that jury doesn't believe that you believe in your case or your client or that you're being honest about what you're talking about and you can't look them in the eyes and tell them these things, you can't ask them for an award. They're gonna say, "Look, I don't believe you. So no matter how good your argument is, I'm gonna doubt you."
Right.
You know. So that's one of the things that I would say to my young self, and my son being a good example, is make sure that you are cleaning out your closet of the demons, of the issues, of the guilt, or whatever you have, because your client is coming to the case being themselves, being authentic. And you, in some regard, are a voice for them, right? You're marshaling the evidence. There'll be a cognitive dissonance for the jury if your client is this honest, authentic, transparent, vulnerable person, and you're not, you know? So, you know, it's easy to say that, and I think it just takes time and experience to do it. It may take some losses.
And that's good feedback for, you know, anyone looking for a lawyer. Find someone that not only makes you feel comfortable, but also someone that comes across as a real human being. Someone that when that person speaks to you, you are seeing someone that you can trust, someone that, you know, inspires trust, you know, and great.
That's one of the beautiful things, by the way, about plaintiff lawyers. We get to choose our cases. And I tell all my clients, you know, you picked me, but I also picked you. I have to trust that you are who you are.
Right.
And I'll have clients that will disclose things that they didn't tell me in the beginning. I feel they weren't being honest. And I'll say, you know, I'm not your attorney, and I'll terminate the representation. Because I know I'm not going to be able to go into trial in 6 months to a year and really do the best job for them.
Right.
So, you know, your clients, yeah, your clients are expecting you. And I think you have a better relationship. And going back to your old boss who got the client to open up more, right? It's really because the person said, this is, you know, I'm sure they say he's a good lawyer, but on top of that, he gets me and he's being honest. And, you know, I think it's their gut feeling. We haven't been able to fully scientifically explain the gut feeling, right? They've done, you hear, you know, YouTube, and there's books about the hostage negotiation and how their gut check is like really high probability of being accurate. And they're doing that with you as your, you know, as a client, and the jury is doing that, right? They got a gut check, you and your client and the defense. And you want to be the person who's ready, who's got the evidence ready to go, who's got the answers, whose client is prepared, and who's being honest on top of all that, because it's not easy to do a trial. I mean, it is very difficult. It's like I don't want to equate it to theatrical because that makes it seem like it's disingenuous. It's not real, but it really is a big production, and it's easy to get lost in that. You know?
I think it's 100% production and theatrical, and you know, the things that apply to actors, because we are being genuine actors. We're performing and we're telling a story, and it's a story that is not created for purposes of trial only. It's a story that happened, and we're just like these communicators, and we need to be good communicators. We need to get out of our left brain and, you know, become this normal person that tells a story like you tell a story in a bar. And I think that's one of the many challenges that trial lawyers have, how to become good storytellers and be on your feet, like improv. I'm a big fan of that, improv. I think you're going to do one of those workshops soon.
I am doing, yeah. Yeah. I would say that the word actor, I actually kid around about this. I tell some of my clients that us plaintiff trial lawyers were just actors that didn't make it in Hollywood. But we're really not acting. I think you nailed it when you said that we're their voice. And part of it is telling their story. And I'll tell it to the jury. There's not multiple versions of the story. There's one story, right? And I always try to bring that up to the jury because, you know, there may be bad facts, but that's part of the true story that's being told. And you're right. We have to effectively communicate that. And the challenge, because most people would think, well, yeah, it's so simple. You can blackboard a story and then just present it to the jury. But you have the defense and their subtle tactics with insinuation and indirect comments and suggestions that the person's not injured or they're lying. There's always these undertones. So we can tell our story, but I think at least 50% of telling the story is being able to integrate the narrative of the other side. right? Because then the jury will really believe that there's one story. So we have to be good communicators, and we have to also prepare in advance that we have to integrate what the defense is going to say. And you can get that through their doctors. You know, I'll depose the defense medical examiner for several hours. I'll send them a $5,000 check for several hours of their time, so I can really understand what they want to say and to lock them down. Because you can then incorporate that when you go to trial as one story. You have to get the right story. And sometimes it's hard. There's confirmation bias on behalf of us plaintiff's lawyers. We drink the Kool-Aid. We listen to our clients and we get really zealous and worked up about it. And we'll lose kind of the big picture, which is what the jury is, right? The jury's right brain and more right brain than they are left brain compared to attorneys. So you gotta figure out what the story is that takes into account the other side. So you're playing both offense and the defense from the get-go, from that opening statement. And you have to, like Nick says, you have to talk about and put out those bad facts. And I think one of the things you wanted me to talk about on your podcast was in this recent case, how one of the defense's evidence we made into, you know, one of the best evidence in our case. You want me to talk about that?
Yeah.
Okay, for so sure. This last case, the defense really wanted to push on gym membership records. And they wanted to establish that my client, after 8 months of treatment, had gone back to the gym and life was normal. And in fact, he was going on a repeated basis. And you know, he's fine, right, folks? You know, so the suggestion is that he's not telling the truth, that his pain is assigned to something else. Mind you, he had like a 8-millimeter herniation and he was in his 20s when the collision took place, and they're arguing that it's all degenerative, or anything other than this crash was the cause of the current pain. And so the defense was super, super, you know, gung-ho about getting this into evidence. And I fought it and I challenged it. And, you know, I made multiple arguments to exclude it and wrote up opposition to it. But I didn't bring it up in my direct examination, having been aware of it before we even went to trial.
So basically you file a motion and you lose the motion to exclude it.
I expected the motion was going to be denied. No, yeah, I expected the motion to be denied to exclude the gym records.
Right. So basically the gym records are coming in and then you're doing direct examination of your client and you don't address the gym records.
I address all the other issues, bad facts, except that one.
Okay, go ahead.
And the defense, you know, as expected, you know, big lead up to it. And, you know, he's reading from his paper, his pad, his yellow pad, all his questions very rapidly. And he, you know, gets into it. But there was a reason for why my client had started to go to the gym. It's because he was doing a lot of therapeutics with a chiropractor and acupuncture. And those doctors had discharged him from that treatment because that modality of treatment was no longer going to help them, but gave him advice to keep working out, to keep doing his exercise at home. And he was doing that. In fact, at one point, I think he was doing it with family members. And he was doing it before he went back to work. This was a blue-collar guy, hard worker, very nice guy who worked at, you know, he was a butcher at a grocery store. But he wanted to keep his job because he had a child that had just been born. He was, you know, young couple, married. So they just wanted to put that out there and say, look, this is a smoking gun. This shows that he's not injured.
The way I see it, Ike, is you are representing a fighter, not a complainer, you know, someone that is like whining all day and just like coming here to whine before the jury. You're actually representing someone who is trying to get better, who is doing their best to live a normal life. And ultimately, it's a hero, you know, the person that you are speaking on behalf of. And before you told this story, I was going to tell you, did you do this where you show, well, my client is experiencing these things. The experience changed. We have not said that he's not able to do these experiences, like going to the gym. We never said he cannot go to the gym. Or maybe we said, you know, he works out less. He's doing other activities at the gym. But the experience of going to the gym is different. And the records are not going to show you that. what they're going to show you is that he went to the gym, right? I don't know what the records show, but...
In this particular case, the story was, this is a guy who wanted to keep working. And you think to yourself, because we both know this just from the battle in the trenches as plaintiff's lawyers, that if he's not working, they'll argue that he should be working.
He should be working. Right? Mitigating the damages.
Yeah, right. And if he's working, they're going to argue he's not injured. So it's a no-win scenario when it comes to the defense and the insurance tactics. So, you know, I think I even suggested that to the jury in some way. But the bottom line was, yeah, this is a guy who is working, and there's a reason for why he went. You know, he wanted to stay healthy. You know, we did talk about the things that he loved to do before that he couldn't do anymore, things that made him happy personally, and the loss of quality of life. We've talked about those things. But yeah, there's just, it could be so politicized,
right?
The personal injury case. Like in another case, I started, you know, addressing the jury, and one of them said, well, I don't know if I can trust you, Mr. Kaluti. You know, I see all these billboards on the freeway, and you're all, you know, promising to do this and that. So, you know, you have to deal with these biases. And there's so many biases with the jury that will prevent your client from getting a fair shake, a fair trial. And so it's through experience and winning and losing cases and getting feedback from jurors afterwards. What I've done in some cases, we've called jurors afterwards and just asked them, what did you think was good? What you think was bad? You know, after the dust has settled, because many of them, they'll just leave the courthouse. They don't want to talk to anybody. They just spent 3 weeks away from their family and job, and they're sick and tired, and they want to get out, right? So you got to call them when they've kind of had some had a moment to step away from the case. But yeah, it's really what I'm learning is it's really about these biases that the defense are invoking through their subtle suggestions. And you have to address those, whether it's through objections, when it's being made, in closing, through your client's direct examination. And so in this case, my client talked about the gym records for the first time on cross-examination and explained what it was about. And you can tell that the wind out of the defendant, the defense attorney's cell had been taken away from him, because now he was kind of scrambling. And the further he went into it, the more the evidence seemed to support the plaintiff. And so he does more questioning, and it just gets worse. But
that's awesome. Yeah, awesome. Good
job. It was a great moment. The judge recognized when she saw that it happened, the kind of the setup. You know, and I attribute it to being overzealous on the defense, but you know, it worked out.
It played well. Favor. Yeah,
and my client got justice. My client got compensation for an injury that he's going to have for the rest of his life. You know, and it's an invisible injury. So
those are hard. Yeah, those are hard for the jurors to empathize with.
Yeah, I'll add that one of the things we use a functional capacity evaluation from a Dr. Ali Bagarian. He is in Northern California, and he does this really thorough multi-hour examination to see, well, is this person telling the truth? Are they injured? Mm-hmm. Do they have the same muscle strength and or weakness that they claim they have? And so he uses medical equipment to test the grip and the strength and the push and the squat and the pull, all these things, so that he can go into trial and say, look, I did this test, and either confirms or it doesn't confirm, you know, that this person has a weakness in the low back or they have range of motion issues. And that became a big deal in this case, because the defense had hired a functional capacity evaluator and pretty much agreed with a lot of what Dr. Bagarian had said. And the jury interpreted, in my opinion, the functional capacity evaluation results as confirmation of my client's injury.
Right.
And that was another objective indication of the injury, because they are invisible injuries.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're hard to, you don't see them you don't see these injuries when the person just walking into the courtroom.
Right. So basically you build a case with damages witnesses, like the family talking about the before and after, how life changed. You know, we were talking with a lawyer the other day about bringing also unbiased witnesses, maybe people that are not that close to the client, and then using these experts, right? And sometimes some experts you don't want to use, the fence is forcing you to use because they are bringing an expert in that field and you don't want to have no one there. You need to contest that. So yeah, it's interesting how trials get built because it's a combination of conveying the human story and then the science behind, and everything needs to be channeled by us trial lawyers.
Absolutely. And you got to coordinate with your client. For example, I'm not a big believer in my client talking about what they cannot do. I think juries, in particular, knowing about personal injury cases, they're questioning whether your client is really injured. And it could be a bias that they had coming in. And so, you know, I don't like my client to talk about what they can't do. I actually want my client to talk about what they can do, although they do it lesser or with pain, or they do it differently, not like before. And I'd rather have a family member come in and talk about what they can do. And by doing so, the jury is hearing honest testimony about what he can do. It's not a woe is me scenario that, oh, you know, have pity for my client. You know, I think that can be a hang up for a lot of juries when they hear someone just go up there and say, oh, I'm so injured, I can't do this. And they look at him and it's an invisible injury and they say, well, you look fine to me. And they're not doctors, but they're going to work with whatever experience, knowledge they have. And they look at you and they say, well, you look fine, right? And here you are telling me how you can't do all these things. It's better to have someone who's a family member, a friend who's like honest, who can talk about the limitations, have them address those, activities of daily living they can no longer do, and have your client talk about what they can do. And I think the jury is smart enough that they'll understand he's doing things with limitations and here's confirmation of things he can't do and it's coming from another source.
Yeah. Great, great stuff. Well, we've been going for over an hour already. I feel like we could stay talking and talking about this stuff that you're seriously very passionate about, and yes, I am too. So, but unfortunately, we'll have to go. If people want to reach out to you, you know, text you or email you, where they can find you?
So, best thing to do is to contact my office, just because I'm normally, For my office, I'm normally in trials, arbitrations, depositions, or mediation. So, you know, I can be found at California Trial Law Group. And the email to reach out to would be manager@courtlawyerca.com, courtlawyerca.com. Or they can call 415-967-4900. They can dial extension 5 and speak to a case manager. But, you know, I tell this to everybody, that if you have a question and we can answer it, and maybe we're not the ones who can help you, we'll direct you to someone who can.
Like me.
like you, exactly. Exactly.
Welcome referrals.
Huh? Yeah, absolutely. And sometimes you have to tell the client that this is an iffy case, that they're going to spend a lot of time and money, and they may end up with nothing. And that's the worst thing that can happen, is to go through that whole process, and then you end up with nothing. It's insult to injury. So, you know, you have to have that conversation with your attorney. So, you know, we welcome folks to call us.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Kind of stuff. Thank you, Ike. Thank you for your time.
Yeah, thank you that for having me.
That was a great episode. Thank you, everyone, for watching. If you like this episode, please don't forget to share it, rate, and also comment. That will help us get to more people. Thanks to everybody for listening, and see you next time.